Don't mind my typing. If you need any printed materials, I have Woodmaster packet over here that I can share. I always print one for myself.
Fortunately, on the new ones, Esther had already printed all out because she needed the review and comment. Figure out how to make charts.
No, don't worry. I forwarded it all your emails to my Gmail. Because, you know, oddly, you cannot, like, you can get your email to sync on your phone, but there's no app where, like, the only way to get your email on a laptop is to mirror your desktop. Huh. It kicks you out all the time. So you have to, like, forward stuff to your own internet account. You can't access our email.
I wonder what IT security thinks about your forwarding policy.
There was nothing confidential in it, but I was probably okay since you were forwarding me a public pack.
Mueller yeah, won't true. Be coming after you.
I doubt they think much of it, but since they're the reasons I can't do it,
yeah.
I concern myself too much with Aria.
Do
you want me to go, Steve?
Yeah, we're ready when you are. It's currently broadcasting, so
right.
I have mic. Sure, we're on here. Yep. Awesome.
It didn't work out so well. All right, good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 10:05. The date is Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyer, Deputy Secretary of State, on behalf of Wayne Williams, Glenn Roper, Assistant Solicitor General, Designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Jason Gallander, Designee of Office of Legislative Legal Services. There are two titles for each measure. One is a statement and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the title board to the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. For anyone who wishes to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the back table, and this hearing is being broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website. When the title board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow three steps. First, board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure the board understands the proposal. Then the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the measure is a constitutional change, the board will consider under CRS 140-106 3.5 whether the measure only repeals in whole or in part a provision of the state constitution. If the board determines it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we take all testimony first, then the board will discuss and vote after all testimony is complete. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Please take note, we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set titles or to the correctness of the titles and summaries themselves. Anyone who is dissatisfied with the decision of the title board may file for a rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. The first item on the agenda is a rehearing on 2017-2018 number 119, transparency in healthcare insurance carrier billing.
Morning, Madam Chair. Thomas Rogers representing objector Deborah Farrell.
And are the proponents present? If you could come up and just identify yourselves for the record so that we know you're here.
Hi, David Silverstein.
Andrew Grimm.
Sure, you can.
And Martha Tierney, counsel for the proponents.
Okay. All right, Mr. Rogers, it's your motion. If you want to walk us through it or if you have anything to add to it.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Farrell's motion outlines her position on 119. I know that you've got a long agenda today, so in the interest of efficiency, I'd like to hit a few key points from the motion, otherwise just stand on what we've submitted. First, the penalty provision at section 1016.147.5 of the initiative was added after review and comment, and that addition was not in response to a comment made in the review and comment memorandum. The amendments are substantial because they contemplate license revocation and civil fines of up to $50,000 per violation. Now, while the review and comment memo on 119 did incorporate portions of the memorandum on 85, a previous and substantially similar measure, these are changes that should have been made prior to the initial submission of 119. The Amendment 80 or the Initiative 85 review and comment memo was released on December 19th. The original version of 119 wasn't filed until mid-January, so there was approximately a month there in which the proponents could have anticipated or could have reviewed the comments on 85 and made changes to their initiative. They chose not to do so. By failing to do so, they've deprived OLLS and Ledge Council of the opportunity to analyze and comment on the changes that they ultimately did make. Unless there are questions on that argument, I'm ready to move on to single subject.
Any questions?
All right. Or do you want to do these? How do you want to?
Well, why don't we just see? I think there are some questions, and then we'll go.
Yeah, Mr. Rogers, my question is, 85 is the review and comment memorandum is fully incorporated into 119 and appears to ask questions that address this issue of enforcement. I know there's a time gap, but is there any case, is there any authority for your proposition that that's actually a problem?
Not that we've found, but it is inconsistent with the purposes behind the statute that require that prohibits substantial changes after review and comment. Waiting until the review and comment period, until after the review and comment period on 119, the proponents again deprived your office of the opportunity to analyze and provide feedback on those substantial changes. That is simply inconsistent with the purpose behind the statute that requires or that prohibits those changes.
But isn't that really the same thing that had happened if instead of doing a new similar initiative in a refiling, they just made the changes to 85, the exact same changes, and brought them to us here?
Well, it is. But the difference here is they had an opportunity to fix the problem. They had the memo on 85, could have made those changes. Instead, they chose to file a new initiative without making changes, again, depriving you of the opportunity to analyze and comment and ask questions about those changes. So it's conduct that shouldn't be permitted. That's our point.
Really quick question. Are you aware of any case law or anything interpreting what makes something a substantial amendment?
I'm not. But again, here we're talking about the addition of a what I think is unquestionably a substantial amendment. The amendment provides for an impact on the licensure of the covered healthcare providers and or the insurers, I should say, and also a five-figure penalty. So if that's not substantial, I don't know what is.
And do you have a view as to what the proper interpretation of that term should be?
Sure. There is case law that says a grammatical change, a cleanup, or some minor amendment isn't substantial. So I guess there is that case law. Where that line is drawn, I think, is fairly open to interpretation for this board. But again, I simply can't imagine that the kind of changes that we're dealing with here wouldn't be considered either by this board or the Supreme Court to be substantial.
Thank you.
I do have one other question. Do you believe that if these changes had been made to 85 as opposed to a new initiative, that they would be directly responsive to the 85 memorandum?
Yes. And I'll say that, well, yes, as to 119, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Tierney, go ahead.
I just want to make sure, Madam Chair, do you want to take these arguments one at a time? Or?
Yeah, let's take this one.
I think
we'll take single subject clarity.
So what Mr. Rogers doesn't mention and what I would like to raise, first of all, I'd like to put the review and comment and the initiative for 85 into the record, if that's okay.
Sure.
I have copies for Mr. Ward here. And actually, I have copies for Mr. Rogers, too. Oh.
Okay. And then I just have a question. Is this just the review and comment memo? Oh, this is for 85. Got it.
Yep.
Thank you.
And then what you'll see in the review and comment memo for 119 and for all of the measures that you're hearing this morning on this topic, on rehearing, so 119 through 123, is that the review and comment memos not only talk about Initiative 85, but at the top of page 2, also talk about Initiative 118. 118 was submitted to Ledge Council at the same time as 119 through 123, but was later withdrawn. And because it was the first initiative submitted in that packet, it has the most lengthy review and comment memo.
Where are you looking at again? Sorry, I'm...
Here. If you look at the review and comment memo for 119, on the top of page 2, this initiative is one of a series identified as initiatives 27, 2018, 118 to 122.
Thank you.
The memo for 118 is much longer than the memos for 19 through 123 because it goes through all of the issues, that the Ledge Council or Ledge Council and Ledge Legal Services wanted to raise, and then they incorporated that memo into 119 through 123. If I might, I would also give these to Mr. Ward to place into the record and to give to Ms. Ward. Yep. And that memo in particular at paragraphs 10 and 11 goes directly to the enforcement issue that is at issue here in the change to 119.
Page 7?
Yes.
Okay.
So to the extent that Mr. Rogers' argument is premised on this time gap, that is certainly not the case. That this was again discussed with Ledge Council in more detail and Ledge Legal Services in the review and comments for 118 through 123, and that resulted then in the change that you see in 119, and you'll see that change in several of the other measures you're going to see this morning as well.
Any questions?
No. Would you agree that it is a substantial amendment?
I
if I understand your argument as to it all being incorporated, but do you have a view as to whether it would satisfy that language from the statute?
Well, the language, as I understand it, is and the case law turns on whether the amendment is made in direct response to a comment from the Legislative Legal Services. So,
say we had determined that it was not. Would you consider this a substantial amendment?
I think it imposes penalties that flow directly from the primary subject of the measure. But I guess I probably wouldn't be standing in front of you today if I didn't have comments 10 and 11 to back up the reason for why we changed the initiative in direct response to that discussion.
Okay.
Anything else?
No.
You want to respond, Mr. Escher?
So just one comment. The amendments that were made after review and comment specify penalties. And the two paragraphs of the review and comment memo on 118 that Ms. Tierney has referred you to, I would suggest that those adding penalties are not responsive to these comments. These two comments and questions concern the rulemaking authority of the Commissioner of Insurance and the Board of Pharmacy. While there is kind of an oblique reference to enforcement and penalties, it does not appear to me that the amendments that were made to 119 could have been made in response to paragraphs 10 and 11 of the 118 review and comment memo.
Any discussion? Let's vote on that one separately.
Okay. All right. I believe regardless of 118, I think that notwithstanding the time gap, these amendments, which I believe are substantial, were made in direct response to comments in number 85, review and comment memo, which was incorporated into these. So I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing to the extent that alleges we don't have jurisdiction due to substantial amendments being made after the review and comment hearing.
Just really quickly, I don't know if this is for Jason or Martha, where in the 85 memo specifically, just so I can.
Okay. And this one would be,
I think it's paragraphs 28 and 29 of the substantial comment.
Thank you.
29, right, 28E and 29.
I'll second it.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any discussion?
No.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Mr. Rogers, that takes us to single subject.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The initiative violates a single subject requirement. Again, Ms. Farrell's full argument is made in the motion, but I'd like to focus on the initiative's requirements. At 10.16.147.3, that requires insurers to disclose, quote, all forms of remuneration derived from rebates and other forms of incentives received as the result of healthcare services of prescription drugs or medical devices, close quote. The stated single subject of 119 is transparency in healthcare billing. This requirement goes beyond the stated purpose. While other provisions of 119 are designed to help the consumer understand the cost of healthcare services, this provision goes much further. It's designed to get to why the cost of healthcare services are what they are, and it gets into the insurer's profit and loss, business methods, et cetera. It is not merely concerning how much the consumer is paying. Other provisions of this measure help the consumer get to that transparency in healthcare billing. This one simply does not, and it is a separate subject that requires the board or deprives the board of jurisdiction to set a title on this measure. Otherwise, we'll stand on the arguments in our motion.
Okay.
With regard to single subject.
Any questions? Ms. Tierney, you want to respond? Or
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's important to note that, you know, the single subject requirement is directed against two specific evils, the act of log rolling, that is increasing voting power by combining measures that could not be carried on their individual merits, and surprising voters by surreptitiously including unknown and alien subjects coiled up in the folds of the proposal. The argument here does neither. In fact, goes directly to fulfilling the single subject of the measure, which is transparency in healthcare pricing. And I'm going to have Mr. Silverstein talk to you a little bit about this exact paragraph on remuneration.
So the whole premise of this bill is not merely to help.
Sorry, at the microphone, if you would, on the record.
The whole premise of this bill is that every healthcare transaction, or nearly every healthcare transaction, actually involves multiple parties, right? The patient, the provider, and the payer. And we've created a system in which all three of these parties are part of the transaction, yet patients are responsible in one way or another for the cost through
and
some
just,
form of.
For the record, since we're only doing audio, we're all looking at an exhibit that's titled Healthcare Billing Transparency. Go ahead.
And so within this bill is an understanding that you do not get to transparency in billing practices by merely imposing transparency on any one part of the system. So within the bill, there are a section covering the pharmacies because they're licensed differently, providers, and the insurance carriers. They are involved in every transparency. And those forms of remuneration back to insurance carriers are being paid by the patients. So this is not a simple example of one-to-one relationships where you buy a car from a dealer and then there's some relationship with between the dealer and the automobile manufacturer. There's actually three parties involved in the transaction. Patients are led to believe that insurance carriers are negotiating on their behalf, and then there are other forms of remuneration going on in that transaction that the patient does not have transparency into. So because there's three parties involved in every transaction, and in many cases, in the case of self-employed, self-funded employers, actually four parties involved in every transaction. The only way we achieve the objectives of this goal, which is true transparency in healthcare billing, is we do have to unmask what happens at the top of the triangle there. So this is rather broad, but that's because every price transparency measure that's ever been tried anywhere in the country only addresses the right side of this triangle. This measure is intended to be comprehensive and actually affect the system by giving patients what they need.
Can you provide, Mr. Silverstein, an example of how this provision actually helps a patient? Like, what can a patient do? What would they know that they don't otherwise know, or how does this help a patient?
So, for example, there is a medication that you buy every month, and today it costs $80 at Walgreens. However, next year, Walgreens and the pharmaceutical company agree that every time you buy that medication, Walgreens gets a $20 rebate from your insurance carrier. Right? But you're on a high deductible plan, so you're paying the whole $100 now. They're charging $100 instead of $80. You've paid the entire $100 because you haven't hit your deductible yet, and $20 is actually going back to the insurance carrier. So even though you are paying it and it is a component of that transaction, you don't have any transparency into that, in which case you would prefer to be paying cash perhaps for that rather than buying it from Walgreens through your insurance carrier. These are the kinds of things that are going on behind the scenes, but it's not just about consumer protection. It is about transparency into the billing and pricing process, because you are the responsible party, but there is a negotiation that's gone on between two other parties that you are not privy to. That only happens in healthcare. Healthcare is indeed unique, but that is very much an example. Another example would be that a medication that's very commoditized and only costs $2, you go in and you pay $15 because your copay is $15. And that $13 difference, that's going back very often either to the insurance carrier or to the prescription benefit manager, and you don't have any transparency into that. So it's not just about costs. This is what you are paying, what you are effectively being billed at the counter in that case by the pharmaceutical, by the pharmacy.
But it doesn't affect your bottom line cost. You still have to pay it.
It does. It also very much affects the employers. So consider the fact that 60-65% of employers now are self-funded. So it is not actually the insurance company paying these costs. The employer is paying these costs, or the patient is paying these costs if they're on a high deductible plan. So it very much, you do not have transparency into the price that has ultimately been negotiated. You don't have transparency into that billed price. So Martha's asked me to explain how this will change the behavior of the marketplace for the consumer or for the employer. Having transparency into billing allows you to make a set of comparisons, and that is what is missing from the marketplace, is the pressure that comes from different parties seeing prices and being able to comparison shop. So, for example, an employer, when evaluating two insurance carriers, can only evaluate premiums today, the differences in premiums, the difference in copays, but they can't ask what has been negotiated with that pharmacy down the street from my factory, or what has been negotiated with the hospital down the street from my factory, what is my insurance company going to pay for those services. So we have a facade going on right now that suggests that insurance carriers are negotiating for and representing the best interests of the patients and the employers, and it just turns out not to be true.
I'm done.
Any other questions?
Not on that one.
No. Anything else you want to add?
I'm assuming that I better hit on the two other issues that Mr. Rogers addressed in his brief, just briefly. Both are provisions. One is a provision related to private contractual arrangements between insurance carriers and healthcare providers, and the other is provisions allowing for adverse licensure action. Both are intended to carry out the single subject of the measure, which is transparency here in healthcare billing pricing, so that if you understand the contractual arrangements between the insurance carrier and the healthcare provider, as Mr. Silverstein was just explaining with that diagram, then you will have full transparency as to what you are actually being billed and will have to pay for a particular service. And the adverse licensure action, again, is part of this penalty and enforcement provision directly related to the single subject of the measure.
Mr. Roger, or any questions? No, you have a response?
Madam Chair, so I listened carefully to that explanation, and I didn't hear anything that led me to believe that this provision would provide any additional information to a consumer about how much a particular healthcare service or good costs. I understand the argument to be yes, but it helps us understand why the cost may be higher or lower. That is a second subject. Every provision of this measure is focused on transparency in healthcare billing, that is, communicating to the consumer what the good or service will cost, except this one. This one delves now into why, not how much, but why, and into the business of the relationship between the insurance carrier and the provider. It is simply inconsistent with transparency in billing and violates the single subject rule.
So you heard the explanation of the Walgreens pharmacy and the other example. Is there some other kind of payment that you were contemplating in your objection here that we should be aware of that could be captured in here and that could be a concern?
Well, yes, the language is very broad. Rebates or incentives. You know, that could be a government subsidy to an insurer for efficiency in billing, to the extent we've got you know, a public entity involved. It could be reinsurance payments to a primary insurer by another insurer. It could be loyalty rebates and incentives offered by vendors, which I think is the issue that the proponents are focused on. But again, while those may impact the cost to the consumer, this provision provides no additional information to the consumer about what they will pay. The measure otherwise requires that information. This is just an outlier. I get that the proponents want to know this information. I suppose I'd like to know it too. It simply just does not fit within the single subject as articulated by the proponents for this measure.
So in the title that we set, we describe it as a requirement that healthcare insurers publish health insurance plan information. Well, I mean, that was the language we used, as opposed to transparency in healthcare billing. If I'm looking at the right page here, you think it still does not fall under that description?
2 points on that, Mr. Roper. First, I also look at the way that the proponents have articulated single subject, and in the recitals for this measure, they refer repeatedly to transparency in healthcare billing. The board has set the single subject as concerning a requirement that healthcare insurers publish health insurance plan information, but when you get into the guts of this, every one of these requirements is about providing information to the consumer about the price of healthcare. So you start with the basis for determining payment or reimbursement amounts, items that appear as charges, but that the insurer doesn't pay. That's information about the cost. Detailed coverage and negotiation payment information by plan type and provider. Same. It's all the same until we get down to all rebates or other incentives. That, again, has nothing to do with providing the consumer with information about what. How much the cost is, only about why it may cost more in a particular instance.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the important couple things. First of all, I think that the example and the comments by Mr. Silverstein make clear that it is then the consumer will have the information about what the what they are being charged, as opposed to what the item is costing, to make choices about where they want to get their healthcare, or where they want to get their drugs, or where they want to get their insurance. So that is all part of the single subject of the measure. Another important point is that the measure does allow for the commissioner to promulgate rules regarding these publications. So it is not going to be something that the providers or the carriers aren't going to know. Like, they're going to know what the commissioner's rules say, what they're going to have to do to post based on section 3 there.
Mr. Rogers mentioned reinsurance. Do you think reinsurance payments would be captured under this provision?
No.
Okay.
Anything else? No. Okay. Thanks. Okay. Any discussion? I mean, I think our title still describes it. I don't think it was described to us necessarily as being limited to just billing, but rather the publication of health insurance plan information. And I think that that's contained in the single subject. I'm not sure that I see this as so disconnected or unnecessary that it would be a second
subject. But.
I agree. As to all three of the bullet points there, I think they're all, you know, the last two are sort of enforcement mechanisms and making it effective. And the first one, I think, is related to the overall subject of the measure as far as publishing health insurance information.
Then without comment, I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on this initiative 119 to the extent it alleges multiple subjects. I find the board has jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. So Mr. Rogers, that takes us to the title language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Ms. Farrell's motion includes her complete arguments, but I would like to highlight one in particular. The title that you've drafted informs the public that the measure requires disclosure of payment amounts to healthcare providers. But it fails to note the expansive definition of that term used in the initiative. I think the public would be shocked to learn that healthcare provider, as defined in this initiative, includes not just doctors and nurses, but folks like athletic trainers, massage therapists, social workers. I think in the common parlance of healthcare provider, these professions are simply not included. And so to give the public a clear picture of what this measure does and what it's regulating, the list of you know, both healthcare, traditional healthcare providers and others that would simply not be considered in common parlance healthcare providers must be included in the title. Otherwise, we'll stand on our submission and happy to take any questions.
But aren't many of those categories covered by insurance? I guess I wouldn't necessarily think they weren't healthcare provider. What else are they?
I don't know the answer to that, but I would never consider a social worker. It just a common definition of the term healthcare provider. I would never consider an athletic trainer, a massage therapist, or a social worker to be a healthcare provider.
Well, I think a lot of social workers work in the psychology field. Like social workers are not necessarily just, you know, I mean, that's their degree. They work in the schools. They work in the,
sure,
you know, and they're hired by Kaiser. There are certain social workers that I don't think would be healthcare providers.
I don't know. Under the definition in the measure, I think a social worker in a school may be covered by this initiative. And
they're not billing, but yeah.
Well, you know, I'm sure that if we thought about it for a minute, we could come up with, I mean, look, an athletic trainer is someone that may bill for their services. When I go to the gym and see an athletic trainer, I don't consider that athletic trainer to be a healthcare provider. Yet that person is regulated by this initiative. And I think that would be shocking to the public. If I go for a massage and that person charges me for those services, that seems to be covered by the initiative. I think the public would be shocked to know that, you know, the massage therapist at the, you know, at the spa may be covered by this initiative.
So would you think we would need to list out all of the definition and the initiative for what constitutes a healthcare provider?
I think that's right, Mr. Roper. If not listing all of them out, at least listing some of those out that are farther afield from the traditional definition of healthcare provider.
If I might, Madam Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
So if you look at the definition, which is on page 2 of the measure, 62302-4D, it makes clear that list is only persons who are licensed, certified, or registered by the state under Title 12 or Article 3.5 of Title 25 to provide healthcare services. So it is when that massage therapist is acting as a licensed healthcare provider that they are covered by this. And usually when you go to the massage parlor, they tell you what they're going to charge you for a massage. Sorry. guess we don't usually call it a parlor these days, do we?
No, that's a whole different.
Oh, dear. Same with an athletic trainer, right? So you might get physical therapy ordered that either is given by a physical therapist or then they say you need to go and continue to do this work. And that might be provided by an athletic trainer. But if they're just somebody you go to at the gym, they're telling you what they charge you by the hour. So it's not going to be different. What did? What do you mean?
Requiring to publish their top 25, 15, or 50 prices, depending on their size.
So one more thing for the record. Apparently, Senate Bill 65, which became law this year, requires all of these folks listed in subparagraph D, subsection D, to list their pricing over a certain size. So this is consistent with existing law. Let me say one more thing about sort of clear title. The cases are very clear that you do not have to list every single nuance of a measure in the title. And to suggest that we would need to list all of these in the ballot title, I think, would not be something that the court would find clear or helpful to the voter.
I don't have Title 12 in front of me. Does it list out the same list of people? Because I thought that massage therapists were licensed by DORA, or, I mean, I think, you know, for general, like they have to have a license, but maybe it's different if they're a, quote, healthcare provider,
right,
versus...
Right, I think that is a key distinction, that you might have a massage therapist come to you, visit you in the hospital to give you massage in the hospital. And the hospital is saying, here is this massage therapist. We want you to get this massage on your leg.
Right.
And in that instance... that massage therapist would be required to be publishing their pricing so that you would know whether or not that's in, you know, they have a relationship with the hospital or if that's going to be considered in your network or out of your network or what it's going to cost you. So I think the definition makes clear that it is only when those folks are acting in that capacity as licensed healthcare providers, providing licensed to provide healthcare services, that they would be covered here.
So let me push back just a little bit on that, because it says a person who's licensed under Title 12 to provide healthcare services. Title 12 is very broad, and you know, involves all sorts of different kinds of licensure or registration. And then when it says to provide health care services, if you go down to paragraph 5, it defines a health care service as a service delivered by a health care provider. So you have kind of a circular definition there where a health care provider is one who provides a service. A service is one provided by a health care provider. So I'm not sure it's true that this paragraph D wouldn't encompass everything that these individuals do.
But if you think of the example that Mr. Rogers was giving, like if you go to a personal trainer, well, there you know what you're paying. Nobody signs up for a personal trainer without understanding what the personal trainer is going to charge them. So
So they are publishing their pricing. It's really in these situations where it is ordered as a treatment, let's call it that, where you aren't knowing up front. It's not like you're going to the gym and saying, all right, I want to go to that trainer who's going to charge me $50 a session to train me. It's different if your doctor or the hospital is saying, this is the service you need, and you have no idea what it's going to cost, because you're not signing up for it in the regular sense, like Mr. Rogers was indicating. Same with, you know, my massage parlor example.
Do you have any questions?
No. How do you want to take these? Do you want them to go through the rest of the bullet points or address this one?
No. Let's do all the bullet points and then, yeah. Did you not want to add anything else?
I don't want to add anything else on the remaining points of the motion, but okay. I did want to make one, maybe two points with regard to Ms. Tierney's presentation. First, the case law also tells us that the title must not be misleading. That's the problem here. Frankly, her argument that, a massage therapist or an athletic trainer already tells you their price completely misses the point. The point here is that the public would be shocked, stunned, and amazed to find that this measure on transparency and healthcare billing is going to regulate athletic trainers, massage therapists, social workers, as healthcare providers.
Ms. Tierney, did you want to add to anything else of his other points on the clear title that he didn't?
Sure. The other two points that I raised in the motion are explain that the initiative delegates rulemaking authority. Many, 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 many initiatives that come before you have rulemaking authority, and I don't think I've ever seen it in a title. It is not. It is more of an implementing feature that I don't think needs to go in the title. And I believe that we've already hit on the last argument in the sense that the title. At sub 3, detailed coverage and negotiated payment information by plan type and provider, prescription drug prices negotiated with providers, pharmacies, distributors, and manufacturers. So I think that that is getting to the issues contained in the third bullet. And again, the title gives the voter sufficient information to understand what is in this measure as written.
Well, I think I'll start.
Okay.
And just say, first, where I would go is, I think I would deny the motion for rehearing on the broad range of providers issue for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think it's actively misleading, notwithstanding what Mr. Rogers said. I don't know that people would actually be shocked, stunned, or amazed that these people are included. Also, I just don't see any way to list all of these folks and comply with our brevity requirements, and I don't see a very easy way to distinguish how to choose which ones not to list if we started adding some of those folks in. On the issue of the remuneration, I didn't hear any specific language suggestions. I don't think we need to do anything. I might consider in clause 5 of the title making it a little clearer by saying something like, instead of all rebates or other incentives, all healthcare related rebates or other incentives received. That goes back to insurance insurers
publishing, and I think that makes it clear that they're getting them, not giving them out, which I think is consistent with the measure and that it's related to healthcare. And I wouldn't say anything at anything regarding the delegation of rulemaking authority issue. I think we don't usually do that.
I agree on the rulemaking. I am still a little concerned about, and just looking at Title 12 in 2014, it looks like just the one example I was asking about, it looks like the legislature moved massage therapists into Title 12. And I'm not sure how many of these other categories are also in Title 12. I think that the people in those occupations, at least, might be surprised to know that they are subject to this. And perhaps people in the public might be a bit surprised to know that things that aren't typically being billed through insurance would now be subject to this. For instance, marriage and family therapy. There's some other categories that aren't in here that are in Title 12, and it looks like all of Title 12 would be included. And then the list that they have is, you know, including these people. So there's other things in Title 12, like chiropractors are in there, but it looks like even coroners and things like that, I don't know that they bill, but
might be a little late for healthcare.
Yeah, it might be, but they're in here, so I don't know if there's something associated with that, and they're included in Title 12 because they're licensed. Does that mean that they have to then disclose? So maybe a category. I don't think we would have to list them all, but maybe we should say something about healthcare providers and other. I don't know what we would call it, but health-related occupations or something like that, so that at least it triggers people to know that there is a list out there of things they might not consider a quote provider. I don't know.
We don't have any problem with adding a broad category like that. I think right. Adding, you know, 57 names is problematic. But if you wanted to say a comprehensive list or
right.
What I might suggest is maybe in the current title, right before the first reference to healthcare providers on line 4, saying, and it's the way we have it listed out, it's kind of weird. I don't think we need to repeat it, saying something like to a broad range of healthcare providers is defined in the measure or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be fine with me too.
We have no objection to that.
Okay. All right, Mr. Rogers, what do you think of that, or do you have some other language you would propose? I think we're not inclined to do the list, but we probably are inclined to at least say this is not necessarily people that bill your insurance.
Sure, like to see a list.
Yeah, okay. All right, what's your language?
Okay, Steve, I think on line, let's see. On line 4, right before the first word, I would say a broad range of healthcare providers. And maybe I'd leave it at that, unless you think we need to do the as defined by the measure. To me, that's
I'm fine with that.
Just leaving it where I had it.
That's fine. I'm okay with that.
Okay.
I also like the suggestion of bolstering the rebate language a little bit to make clear that it's rebates received by the insurer.
The screen will come back on shortly.
We're having technical difficulties.
We will have IT do their magic when we break for lunch.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I'm ready.
Sobeck. So on line, not line five, line seven, right after line five, I think between all and rebates, I'd say put in healthcare related. And then after incentives, I would just add received.
Received by the insurer, or do you think received is?
I feel like it says up above requiring health insurers to publicly disclose on line three before the column, so I think it relates back to that.
Okay.
All right. So the way it reads right now is a change to the Colorado revised statutes concerning a requirement that healthcare insurers publish health insurance plan information and in connection therewith requiring health insurers to publicly disclose, one, the basis for determining payment or reimbursement amounts to a broad range of healthcare providers, two, the items that appear as charges on an explanation of benefit that the insurer does not pay, three, detailed coverage and negotiated payment information by plan type and provider, four, prescription drug prices negotiated with providers, pharmacies, distributors, and manufacturers, and five, all healthcare related rebates or other incentives received authorizing penalties for violations and prohibiting any contract between a health insurance plan and a healthcare provider from restricting the publication of the required health insurance plan information.
Right. Then I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that we've amended the title and adopt the title as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 120. Mr. Rogers. Oh, yes, Ms. Tierney. And if you could just, for the record, tell us your proponents are still here, okay. And we're fine.
That's fine. Martha Tierney, counsel for the proponents, David Silverstein, and Andrew Graham, who are present.
All right, Mr. Rogers.
Madam Chair, Thomas Rogers for the objector, Deborah Farrell.
And do you want to walk us through your motion for rehearing?
Madam Chair, let me keep this very short. First, I'd like to incorporate the argument on 119 as applicable here, in particular on the substantive changes to the initiative after review and comment. Second, we'll stand on the single subject and language arguments as they're presented in the motion. Happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Tierney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. I, too, will incorporate my comments and Mr. Silverstein's comments made on the record in response to the motion for rehearing on Initiative 119. And the arguments presented in this motion are entirely subsumed, I believe, within the arguments that were already made on 119, with the exception maybe of the identity of who is doing the rulemaking.
Okay. Any questions by anyone on the board?
No.
All right. Any discussion or motion?
Yeah, I think unless there's disagreement, I think I agree that what we've done with 119 also covers the arguments for this proposed measure, except that we don't need to make any changes to the language because those provisions aren't in this one. This is a narrower measure.
Okay.
That, if we're ready for a motion, I would just move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18, number 120, in all respects.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 121. All right.
Madam Chair, Thomas Rogers for the objector, Deborah Farrell.
Madam Chair, members of the title board, Martha Tierney, counsel for the proponents, David Silverstein and Andrew Graham, who are present.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Rogers.
Madam Chair, first, I'd like to begin by incorporating argument on initiatives 119 and 120 with regard to the substantial amendments made after review and comment. But I'd like to go on to one additional point on that topic, and this is an important one. So the proponents have argued that the changes they made to the penalty section of 121, or I suppose they will make this argument, that those changes are responsive to questions 28 and 29 in the review and comment memo for Initiative 85. That argument's wrong in this case. First, the review and comment memo on 85 says that the comments and question in that memo are incorporated, quote, to the extent applicable to 121. Well, in this case, the comment is not applicable to 121 as it was filed with Ledge Council and OLLS. The comment in the 85 memo was, quote, the proposal does not include penalties for violating the requirements of the statute as amended, close quote. The memo then asks if there should be penalties for noncompliance. Well, 121, as filed, did include penalties for violating the requirements of the measure, specifically that the provider can't bill the patient if it has failed to publish its fee schedule as required by the initiative. That's that. Having responded by adding a penalty section to the 121 as filed, nothing further would be responsive to that question, the question in the 85 memorandum. As a result, item 29 from 85, from the 85 review and comment memo, is simply not applicable in this case, and no further changes may be made in response to that question. It cannot be the law that a topic once raised in a review and comment measure on another similar measure, simply by an incorporation by reference, gives the proponents carte blanche to make any changes they wish to the language about the topic raised in the question. If that were the law, it would again defeat the purpose of 141052 by depriving OLLS and Ledge Council of the opportunity to analyze and comment on all substantive provisions of the measure before filing with the title board. 121 must be sent back for another round of review and comment.
Okay. Any questions?
All right. I just want to note, this is a substantially different argument than the one that was made on 119 and 120.
Okay. Ms. Tierney?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. In response to Mr. Rogers' argument, I'd like to point the members of the title board again back to the review and comment memo for Measure 118, and in particular to the substantive comments in paragraphs 8 and 9 on page 7. Those comments go directly to the change that was made in 121.
Where are you looking?
The review and comment memo for 118. On page 7, paragraphs 8 and
related to the penalties?
Related with to the hold harmless provision that was eliminated.
Are we there yet, or are we talking? I think we're on the penalty argument still, right? We're on the addition of the penalties argument. And I believe Mr. Rogers' argument is that it's not responsive in this case for a different reason, in that a penalty was already included, and therefore any supplemental penalties being included are
essentially redundant and non-responsive. I believe that's the argument, if I'm following it right.
I would refer you back to both Measure 85 and the review and comment for 85 and the review and comment for 118, comments 10 and 11. Where there was extensive conversation about enforcement and penalties.
Yeah. I also...
I apologize. I had jumped ahead to bullet three.
Sure. The other question is, I believe Mr. Rogers only referenced question 29 in the number 85 memo, but there's also 28E. Is there a penalty associated with failing to publish? And it seems like that's what was addressed in 121 before making amendments. But then the 29 is other penalty provisions just in general for sort of the whole measure. And I think that's what was addressed in response to that question as an amendment. That's my understanding. If I know you're up here, but I think it's a question for Mr. Rogers if he disagrees with that.
So, Mr. Gillander, this is one of the omnibus measures. So it includes right. all three sections, pharmacy, insurance, and providers. Question 28E deals with only one of those categories. So the way I read this is 29 then says, essentially, what about the other two categories? But all of those references in 85, of all of those references, the change we're focused on is in 103.7, which I believe is addressed, you're right, by 28E. Okay. But it is, I think that answers your question. I hope it does.
Right, but I thought your issue was that the provision in 1016.147 subsection 5 was not responsive in this one, and I think it's still responsive to 29. You were arguing that question 29 in number 85 doesn't apply to 121, and I'm trying to follow that, unless I've misunderstood your argument.
I think Mr. Rogers was on bullet 3, too.
I think I was, too.
Okay. So we're good on this bullet.
At least we are on the same page.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me just take a quick look and make sure I'm... Yeah.
Okay.
Can we go through this one more time? I'm sorry. I just want to make sure we are on the same page. So 28 and 29 address between them all three of the topics of 121.
Right.
When I believe that when 121 was filed, it included additional penalty language on all three of the topics: pharmacy, insurance, and provider. So that is our complaint. That
I see.
That 85 said you don't have any penalties. When 121 was introduced, it had penalties, I believe, in all three areas. Then, after review and comment, additional changes were made, and those were improper. Those require additional review and comment.
Because the fact that it had some penalties to begin with was essentially responsive to the question, and you're saying that somehow they can't supplement that response. They can't respond to that question again or something. Or the question didn't apply to 121 because they'd already responded to it in the initial draft of 121.
That's exactly it. The question in the 85 memo was, should there be penalties? 121 is introduced, had penalties. So the language, the incorporation language that says 85 applies to the extent it's applicable, well, it's simply not applicable. It's a nonsensical question as to 121 because the penalty provisions have been included.
So they would have needed to ask something like, should there be more penalties?
Should you change the penalties? Are these the right penalties?
How about in 29 where it says, have you considered the nature and severity of the penalties?
Well, sure. And they did consider the nature and severity of the penalties when they included a penalty provision or three penalty provisions in 121 as introduced. So they answered the question. And Mr. Gellner's right. Our position is that the memo would have needed to ask another question. not should there be penalties or have you considered what they should be. It would have had to say again, well, we've looked at your penalty provisions and now we have this question about them. Look, can I go on? I don't want to cut off any questions there may be on that point. I do want to get on to the review and comment memo for 118. That's okay. So first, let me note that 118 was pulled down prior to the review and comment hearing. So when we go to the website, we don't find that this letter was published. So to be honest, I'm seeing it for the first time today. It puts us at a substantial disadvantage here. That said, it appears that that 9 doesn't really have any impact here. 9 regarded the use of the term hold harmless, and while that word is struck, the entire there's an entire sentence that's struck here. And
so are you on to the third bullet point now?
I am on to the 103.7 bullet point, which is
yes. Okay,
the third bullet point. Yes.
Thank you.
I must say, seeing this for the first time, it does appear that there was a question that in the 118 memo that this change is responsive to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. I just wanted to respond to this issue on that I didn't respond to the first time because I was on the wrong bullet point, which is this notion that there was a penalty and then the penalty was changed. The discussion in the review and comment for 118 also talks about how the commissioner is going to enforce and what enforcement is going to look like in substantive comments 10 and 11. And that language and talks about discipline. So that is where we came up with the change to the penalties in addition to the language from 85 and further discussion that was had in the review and comment.
Could I ask a quick question? Unless I'm missing something, in the introduced version or the original version of 121, am I correct that there weren't actually penalties? The only thing that might be classified as a penalty that was in that was the bit about not billing the patient if you don't publish. It looks to me like all the other penalties were new language that was added after the review and comment hearing.
Am Agreed.
I missing that?
No, that's right. You'll see if you look in the red line.
Yeah.
And I had that same question. Maybe it's for Mr. Rogers as to what penalties he's talking about with respect to Measure 121 that were in the original.
So, Mr. Roper, those are the penalties at 620.105. Sorry, 103.7. Sorry. Right, 103.7. So the original language was, if at the time a patient receives a healthcare service from a healthcare provider, the healthcare provider has failed to publish its fee schedule or charge master in accordance with this section, the healthcare provider shall not bill the patient or third party payer for the healthcare services rendered to the patient, and the patient shall not be responsible for paying the charges. It goes on to say the healthcare provider may bill a carrier with which it has a contracted, regardless of its compliance with this section. However, the patient shall be held harmless by both provider and carrier for any balance. Then the changes that were made after review and comment were that the last sentence was struck. So the sentence that reads the healthcare provider may bill, that was struck, and there was an addition at the end of the remaining, or an insertion, so the last After the last comment, it read, and the patient and third-party payer shall not be responsible for paying the charge.
So the held harmless language is what you were calling the penalty that was in the original draft?
Well, no, I think all of 7 is a penalty.
Okay.
The penalty is if you don't publish your charges, you can't bill the patient.
Thank you.
I think preliminarily on that argument, my thought is, I mean, I don't know, that's certainly a disincentive and obviously could cost a provider money. I don't know that I consider it a penalty in sort of the traditional sense. You know, they're not being fined or something or having some sort of licensure action against them or paying money to a government that's enforcing this. So to some extent, I'm not sure that applies. But more so, I feel like, and I'm still relying on exclusively the review and comment memo for 85, especially given the withdrawal of 118. I'm not entirely sure if it's appropriate that we even consider the 118 memo, although I guess it is incorporated. I just think that questions 28E went to that provision 103.7. Question 29 still applies, and for the same reasons as in 119 and 120, and covers the addition of the other penalties after the review and comment hearing for 121. And the argument's interesting, but I just think it's very hyper-technical to sort of say that, well, there was a question and you tried to respond to it when you originally resubmitted, and then you might have thought about it some more and modified again, still thinking about the same question. I think given the, you know, our charge to effectuate the right of initiative and things, that's an awfully hyper-technical construction to engage in. And I'd be inclined to deny on that basis.
Go ahead, Mr. Rogers.
Two points on that, Mr. Gellender. First, it clearly is the penalty provision. That was clearly the intent of the proponents. When you look at 85, there is no 103.7. It stops at 103.6. So the provision that was added was 7, which does impose a penalty. Now, it may be the right penalty or the wrong penalty, but I believe Ms. Tierney has told us that that was the response to the questions 28E and 29. That's what they did.
I guess my question for you, Mr. Rogers, would be then, assuming that's all true, what's the basis for saying they can't essentially supplement that response, that the question doesn't continue to apply through the review and comment hearing? And so, for example, you know, I could see they put in this language, it was in the original 121 about billing a carrier with which it is contracted regardless of compliance, you know, in the last sentence, and then they chose to take it out afterwards. I still think they're figuring out how to respond to the same initial question.
Well, with respect, I don't think that they are. The question was, should there be a penalty, and have you thought about what it should be? And they answered that question definitively by inserting item 7. They said, yep, there should be a penalty in 121. Here it is. Here's the penalty that we choose. They have answered the question. And the argument, the legal argument that you're asking for is, in the review and comment memo, it says that for 85, it says this memo applies to the new series to the extent applicable. Well, where the question has been answered, it's now a nonsensical question to ask. It's nonsensical to say, well, look, I went back and looked at the 85 memo, and it said, do you think there ought to be a penalty? Now, I had inserted a penalty, but in response to that, I wanted to make some more changes, and I thought that, gee, that was just good enough. Fundamentally disagree with that. Once the penalty provision has been inserted, something more is required from the review and comment memo to allow them to make further changes.
Okay. Leaving that aside, on the specific issue of the deletion of the last sentence in 103.7, what about question 19 from the number 85 memo, which talks about essentially resolving the conflict between where a healthcare provider cannot bill a third-party payer. If there were a dispute between a healthcare provider and a patient regarding responsibility for payment, how would this dispute be resolved? And then it goes on a bit. It seems to me that at least that deletion part is responsive to that question.
Sorry, Jason, just to make sure I follow, where were you in 85 still?
85, yes, question 19 on page 5.
Thank you.
Last three sentences.
That's a good question. It doesn't appear to me to be that the change to 121 after review and comment does not appear to be responsive to the question in 19. The question asked there is, this subsection does not state that a third party payer is not responsible for paying the charges, simply that the healthcare provider cannot bill a third party payer. Is that distinction intentional? I don't think the amendment deals with that issue. The amendment deals with resolving this conflict between what a carrier is and what a third party payer is. So I don't see the amendment as being responsive to this question.
Before you sit down, Mr. Rogers, do you have a view as to whether we can look at the 118 memo and consider that?
I do. The review and comment process was not completed as to 118. It was that initiative was pulled down prior to the review and comment hearing. So I would say it is it's a nullity. If the process had been completed, I think it would be a reasonable argument. But without a hearing to complete the process, it shouldn't be given any weight. I mean, for those reasons, in addition to the reasons that it's simply not fair to ask us to consider a letter on a initiative that was pulled down and that was never available to us.
On that same point, though, the proponents, 118 was the first in the series. So 118 is, if you look at it, the lengthiest review and comment memo. It is not for the proponents to have, I mean, we used all of those comments in 118 to apply to all the measures. And so you can't punish the proponents because OLS and Legislative Council didn't incorporate those comments then into 119. They incorporated them all everywhere. Right, and in the review and comment hearings, we discussed those comments in 118 as they applied to 119, 120, 121, 122, and 123.
Anything?
I don't have anything more. I think that, as Jason said, I think specifically the memo in 85, number 28E, I think talks about the failure to publish that covers the subsection 7. But I think 29 specifically talks about in addition to a penalty for failure to publish and goes on and talks about considering other penalties, including the nature and severity of them. So I'm comfortable that that question specifically, 29, would cover the first two bullet points in the motion for rehearing. As to the third bullet point, I'd be comfortable reviewing and considering the memo for 118. I'm a little concerned if, as Mr. Rogers says, it wasn't made available or there wasn't a way for them to review it. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I do think that question 9 in the memo for 118 does specifically go to this point. That it, as to the third bullet point, that it was responsive to that question in number 118. So I would be inclined to deny the rehearing as to all three of those bullet points.
I'm also concerned if the memo is pulled down, but I don't think we can hold that against a proponent of an initiative. They don't have any control over the publication of the memo. So, while I'm not quite sure what to do with that, I'm pretty certain that we can't, attribute that issue back to the proponent. And based on the other arguments, I'm comfortable that they're in response. And I understand the argument that maybe it's not applicable, but I think that that's a pretty broad statement, and I'm not sure it was limited in the way that Mr. Rogers is arguing that particular language, and so I'm comfortable finding that that we have jurisdiction.
All right. Then I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2718, number 121, to the extent it alleges that we lack jurisdiction to set a title due to substantial amendments being made after a review and comment hearing.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, Mr. Rogers.
All right, Madam Chair, I'd like to go on to single subject for 121. And I'd like to highlight several arguments from our motion. First, I'd like to incorporate our earlier argument with regard to 119 on single subject, specifically with regard to the requirement that insurers disclose all remuneration and rebates. Second, with regard to Section 620.103.5 of the initiative, it requires healthcare providers to publish a list of all persons that provide healthcare services, including their relationship with the healthcare provider and other details that would otherwise not be subject to public scrutiny. This disclosure requirement is not related to billing transparency. Instead, it requires a broad disclosure related to personnel matters. For a hospital, this could amount to hundreds, maybe thousands of providers. It adds nothing to transparency in healthcare billing, especially in light of the requirements of the Section 620.105 of the initiative. That section is designed to give the patient information about who is providing services, whether those providers are in or out of network, and how they will bill. With that requirement in place, the requirement that a healthcare provider publish a list of all healthcare providers is not only superfluous, it amounts to a second subject, violates the single subject rule, and deprives the Board of Jurisdiction to set title. Third, as you know, this measure is a conglomeration of three separate measures, 119, 120, and 122, into a single measure. We've talked about two of those already. We're going to talk about the third a little later this morning. Each of those three has its own single subject defects. By combining them into a single measure, 121 even more clearly violates single subject. This measure is broad. It impacts three titles of CRS, the consumer title, the insurance title, and the public health title. It makes substantial changes to the law governing insurers, pharmaceuticals, pharmaceutical drugs, and healthcare providers. It provides for rulemaking by three rulemaking authorities. It stretches its purported single subject transparency in healthcare billing beyond the breaking point, and it must be rejected. Happy to take any questions on single subject.
Anything?
I guess I'll start. We have case law that says things, if multiple provisions are directly connected and related to or are intended to achieve the initiative's central purpose, the provisions do not constitute separate subjects. So, I mean, I certainly agree that this is a broad measure and has a lot in it, but specifically what isn't necessarily and properly connected to, what they're trying to do in achieving essentially healthcare industry transparency or, their general purpose.
Yeah, well, certainly the requirement to list physicians to list healthcare providers is beyond that title, has nothing to do with transparency in healthcare billing. remuneration and rebates section, again, has nothing to do with transparency in healthcare billing.
I'm sorry, let me be more specific. Oh, I meant specifically just the argument about it regulate, you know, three different industries, three different titles, that part of it. Is there anything specific you can point to as to why that's a problem besides that it just does a lot?
Yeah, the umbrella is simply too big. I mean, at some point there is a title, you know, concerning Colorado law is a title that you would find too broad. If we attack three sections of, or if the proponents attack three sections, three titles of Colorado law under the purpose to amend Colorado law, you would find that too broad. So where is the line between something that is an appropriate single subject and something that is simply too broad? Transparency in healthcare billing in a measure that impacts the insurance industry is quite different from a measure that impacts pharmaceutical drugs, and is quite different from a measure that impacts healthcare providers. You're mixing concepts under a title, or under a single subject, that is simply too broad to withstand scrutiny.
Do you think there's a realistic concern that you could have individuals who would want to vote for one of these measures but not the others?
I do. And I think the proponents have that concern as well. I think that's why they've given you 119, 120, and 122. And then in an effort to avoid the use of those individual topic measures is intended to avoid the obvious single subject problem that they've got. There may be a voter who is quite concerned about pharmaceutical drug prices, but could care less about their healthcare provider costs. There could be a consumer that's very concerned about their insurance premiums and about the lack of transparency in statements of benefits they receive from an insurer, but that they don't really think pharmaceuticals or providers are part of the problem. So absolutely.
I'm done for now.
All right. Okay, thank you. Ms. Tierney, Ms. Vaughn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. I too would like to incorporate our comments from 119 and 120 and both mine and Mr. Silverstein's comments into the record for 121. Four of the single subject arguments raised by Mr. Rogers were directly addressed in 119. The fourth, the 6th bullet point is a different topic, but the adverse licensure issue, which is a implementation and enforcement provision directly tied to the single subject. I do want to speak to the issue of the five different measures that are before you today and Mr. Rogers' comment that we must have single subject concerns because we brought you five different measures. That's not the case. What's happening is that there is a bill that is running its way through the legislature, and it remains to be seen whether it will end up with all three provider, carrier, and pharma in it. And if it doesn't, then the proponents may take the piece that is left out to the voters. But the bill that is running its way or will be running its way through the legislature contains all provisions of 121 and 123 very similarly. So that is not why we submitted five measures to you. On the list of all persons that provide healthcare services, out-of-network violations are the primary, one primary complaint that consumers raise and that comes up repeatedly in this healthcare transparency debate. So the reason to require healthcare providers to publish a list of all persons that provide healthcare services is so that patients know whether the provider is going to be in network or out of network. It is not so that it is not for any other purpose other than to give the
patient further transparency about what they are going to be paying for the service that will be provided.
And where to look for their prices, and to look to for the prices.
And where to look to find those prices. Again, I think that the discussion and the testimony or the statements here today from Mr. Silverstein about the interconnectedness of the providers, the carriers, pharmacy, and patients explains why the first bullet is not a single subject. They are all in this measure because this is about transparency in healthcare billing and pricing, and it cannot be achieved if you don't have each of those prongs. And they all flow from that single subject. There's nothing in here, to your question, Mr. Roper, that I emphatically disagree that a voter is going to be for transparency in drug prices, but not for transparency in healthcare costs. That someone who supports transparency in healthcare pricing will support it in all three of these facets, maybe unless they are an insurance company or a pharma owner.
Help me understand a little bit, and this is going to the list of all persons. You said that it's to help identify who's out of network.
In network or out of network.
But this isn't talking about insurance. This is talking about the healthcare providers list.
Should I elaborate on this?
And so maybe I'm just not making that connection.
So when you go into a hospital for surgery and you've scheduled that surgery with your physician, if you've never had surgery before and you don't know the system, there's a very good chance there's an anesthesiologist there who doesn't work for the hospital, doesn't work for your surgeon, who you've never talked to and you've never requested prices from. This is called surprise billing. It's probably been the biggest hot topic in healthcare price transparency for the last decade. When you're in the hospital because a 60-year-old woman broke her hip and the doctor says, you know, I think she might have broken her hip because she's a drug addict, have the addiction counselor come and see her. They call an addiction counselor from down the street who doesn't work for the hospital, who the patient hasn't chosen, and who the patient would have no idea they should ask about their prices. It won't show up on their hospital bill. When they get their bill a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, they may not even remember they had seen an addiction counselor who 3 months later they get a bill from. So when we go in for services, whether to an outpatient surgical center, whether to a hospital, we are often being sent healthcare providers, whether it's a massage therapist, somebody to do a physical therapy evaluation, who does not work for the hospital. And today, they have absolutely no obligation to disclose this information to you. When you call your local hospital and you ask, what does it cost to go to the emergency room? You may get a price and you may get something from your insurance carrier, but they won't tell you that the emergency room physician is an independent physician who doesn't work for the hospital. So it didn't even occur to you to say, oh, by the way, can you tell me what staffing service you use for your ER so I can also call and get their prices? I don't have an emergency right now, but I might next month, and so I'd like to get those prices. So the hospitals, quite honestly, are all in favor of this information coming out. They just probably don't like having to put it out themselves.
Go ahead. Oh, did you have anything? Okay.
If you have any other questions for me.
I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, I've just got a couple of quick points. First, I appreciate Ms. Tierney's explanation that the proponents aren't concerned about a single subject defect. They're really concerned about what's happening at the Capitol. And I would suggest that her explanation about what's happening at the Capitol and her concerns belies the problem with this measure. The policymakers at the legislature may very well decide that it's a good policy to require transparency for pharmaceuticals, but not for insurance companies and providers. Or they may decide that insurance transparency is a good idea, but not pharmaceutical drug transparency. This is the same analysis that the voters are going to go through. So the fact that the proponents are concerned about the policy decisions the legislature will make points you directly to a single subject problem. This is classic log rolling. The proponents are going to cater to, in one instance, those who are concerned about pharmaceutical drug prices. And they're going to, in the bargain, get a vote from that voter for transparency of insurance companies and healthcare providers. That's log rolling. That's exactly what is prohibited by the case law and the statute with regard to single subject. Second, with regard to the out-of-network issue, there is no need for this list of doctors. The reason is that 620.105 B and C cover the same topic. So the healthcare provider, and that could be a hospital, is required to provide information about whether the healthcare services rendered by the provider will be covered by the individual's health insurance as an in-network or out-of-network benefit. And if the individual will receive healthcare services from an out-of-network provider at an in-network facility, whether under 1016-704, the provider is permitted to balance bill the individual pursuant to 1016-704. So it's Section 105 A, B, and C that give the consumer the transparency about in-network and out-of-network, and if out-of-network, how out-of-network will be billed. The requirement for the healthcare providers to publish their list of physicians doesn't address that concern, or at least that does not necessarily address that concern. It is a separate subject, and that is requiring information from the healthcare providers that is not necessary for the consumer to have transparency in billing. Thank you.
Thank you. If I might respond to that last point, 620.105 is only about providers. So, for example, the uninsured wouldn't get any of that information. The provider is only providing that if an individual provides health insurance information to a healthcare provider in connection with the delivery of proposed services.
Although the uninsured also isn't going to care whether they're in-network or out-of-network, right?
Well, maybe they would care what relationship they've got to that hospital, right? Because if they're...
They care more. Where do they turn for prices? If they go to the hospital and they're uninsured, they have no idea that they should be getting prices from other providers that they might see at that hospital that are unaffiliated with the hospital. So in many ways, the uninsured should care much more about this. The self-insured, the cash-paying patient, thinks they're only going to see a bill from the hospital and that they should only ask for prices from the hospital, and they would have no idea that they might see 3, 4, 5 other providers who do not work for the hospital and whose pricing doesn't come through the hospital.
Right. So your point is it goes beyond the in-network or out-of-network. It has to do with getting an understanding of who all is providing the services and where you may be getting a bill
from. Right. There's many different situations covered.
And on the point of the legislation, I tried not to laugh because we all know what influences legislation, and it's not single subject. Maybe 99.9% of the time, it's usually special interests and campaign contributions. So let's not fool ourselves that that's the reason that this is not a single subject.
Sure.
With regard to the in-network, out-of-network issue, I think, Mr. Roper, your back and forth moved us down the road. Right. If you're insured, you care about in-network or out-of-network. If you're not insured, then all of your healthcare providers are going to be covered by this initiative. So that anesthesiologist is regulated. For that matter, your athletic trainer and your massage therapist are covered. So there is a mechanism for the consumer to get the information, the pricing information from each of their providers. So again, 5 is not necessary to increase transparency in billing. It is simply a separate subject.
Right. I'll start. On the single subject, I understand that these are kind of graduated and taking a little bit more in each initiative, but I still think that they are connected, and I don't think it qualifies for what we would describe as log rolling. There are commonly parts of an initiative that a voter might not like. I mean, one typical thing is
you know, just in the kind of enactment clauses, there's commonly an administrative rulemaking authority. I think there's probably lots of voters out there that would like administrative agencies to never be able to pass rules, and they think it's overreach. And but I don't think it's log rolling. I think it's part of the implementation. And so when a measure like this connects some things that I think, you know, there is a chance that a voter likes one and doesn't like the other, but I don't think the measure is in any way surreptitious. It's not trying to have one very popular thing log roll in something unpopular. They're all sort of in the same category. And to the point of at what point does it become too much, I mean, I would agree, a title that even says a change regarding healthcare. And then we had pricing, and then we also got into how that affects the care that a hospital can give you. So if you don't consent to the price or something, they can deny you service, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, we could go down the road of how it would actually impact somebody's care and you know, get into what kind of care doctors are allowed to give or not give. That may, I think, at that point, be problematic. But I don't think something that's limiting itself to consumers obtaining information about pricing, even though there are three different categories, is two subjects. I think, you know, proponents commonly bring a number of initiatives forward. Sometimes it's because they want to go and poll and see whether certain things are popular or not popular before they decide what they're going to circulate. So I'm not really concerned about multiple titles. That seems to be quite commonplace these days. So I'm comfortable with the single subject. Leave it to.
I agree with Suzanne. As for the list of all persons, I also don't think that creates a second subject. Mr. Rogers makes some good points as to why it might not be necessary to achieve the what proponents have described as the purpose of it, but I don't think that I don't think it constitutes a separate subject, separate from the rest of the measure. And then as to the last four bullet points, I think we've already addressed those with respect to the earlier measures.
Motion. I don't have anything
okay.
to add.
Want to make a motion then?
Sure, I can do that. I move that with respect to initiative 2017-18 number 121, that we deny the motion for rehearing to the extent that it argues that the initiative contains multiple separate and distinct subjects.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, Mr. Rogers, that takes us to title.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to incorporate arguments from 119 on the broad range of healthcare providers regulated by the measure. Second, we'll I'd refer you to the arguments in the motion. I'd like to highlight just one of those. The initiative references the publication of fee schedules, and the title references the publication of fee schedules, but omits any reference to the different requirement for healthcare providers that are using the CMS fee schedules. Those providers are able to simply state what percentage of the fee schedule they will use. That is different from publishing a list of prices, and that should be pointed out in the title. And the omission of this difference is fatal to the title, or at least must be fixed, as it tends to or fails to inform the public of this central feature of the measure. This is a lot of providers that would use this alternative method, and it ought to be referenced in the title to make it clear and not misleading. Thank you.
Any questions on that? No. All right, Ms. Tierney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board. I too will incorporate my comments and Mr. Silverstein's comments in regards to the title from measures 119 and 120 into this discussion of the title of 121. The issue about the CMS schedule and whether the provider is using a, or going with their own fee schedule or a percentage of the CMS schedule. I don't think the average voter would have any understanding of what the difference there means. Having them explaining to the voter that their fees will be published is what I think needs to be explained in this title. And if we start getting into charge masters and CMS and things like that, you're going to lose the voter in about the first sentence. So I would suggest that the title as written is clear, tells the voters what they need to understand about what this measure is about. And while it does not contain every nuance of the measure, the case law is very clear that it does not need to.
Just understanding this provision. So the purpose of allowing the use of the Medicaid schedule is essentially an easier, a more administratively easier alternative for providers, essentially?
Much easier. That's the way most providers set their schedules today, both physicians and hospitals in many cases. And so we simply wanted to reduce as much burden as there was as possible. And once you know that various providers reference the CMS fee schedule, all you have to know is my doctor charges 150% and you get to and the other doctor charges 160% of the CMS fee schedule. And all, that's all they have to do is reference, for example, the 2017 CMS fee schedule, we charge 150%. Makes it much easier for the providers.
And that fee schedule is something that's pretty available.
And that's public information.
Right. So.
Nothing. Okay, thanks.
Okay. So I guess I'll start. I think as we did for, 119, we should make those same changes we made there on the broad range of providers and the remuneration. Again, I don't think, as we decided before, we need to talk about delegation of rulemaking authority. On the Medicaid fee schedule, I think I agree with Ms. Turney that that's doing anything about that would likely cause more confusion than anything else. I think the general point is that the information is disclosed and the form is not something that people need to be notified of. On the issue of disclosure of carriers of prescription drug prices negotiated, I don't think we need to add anything. I think in the measure, if we wanted to, after payment information, which if I can find it, on line 5, I might be consider at least doing a clause that just says including prescription drug prices. I've got no objection to that. I don't know that it's necessary.
I'm fine with that. It makes you feel better. I can't log in my laptop either. So.
Should we add in the changes from 119 as well? Stephen, do you remember those?
So I wasn't clear on where we would insert those changes.
This one's a little written differently.
I don't know if you want to say requiring a broad range of health providers.
Okay. Sorry. I hadn't paid attention close enough to realize how different this one is.
I can put 119 up if you want to take a look at what sure. We did there. So this is the language in clause 1.
Okay. Go back now. In this one, maybe what I'd do is, after providers, is say something like, as broadly defined by the measure.
That's fine.
Let's probably set that off with commas.
Madam Chair, if I could I ask one question or make one clarification?
Sure.
In the motion, on page 3, section 3, bullet 2, Mr. Rogers makes the point that the initiative specifically requires insurance carriers to disclose prescription drug prices negotiated with manufacturers. That is the primary distinction between 121 and 123. And when we talked about that last time, the title board did not feel like we needed to include that. But I want to raise that here because we have no objection, if you want to include a reference to manufacturers in the title to address that concern. I don't think it makes the title misleading. And the proponents have no intention of going forward with both 121 and 123. But I did want to make a record about that and raise it.
Okay.
But that's something we would do in 123?
No, you would
do it here.
It's not in 123. It is in 121.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's just the language I just put in, I believe, right? The including prescription drug prices.
Right. Oh, you got something else?
I was just going to say, I'm not sure it's necessarily necessary. You didn't want to put it in the first time, but I just don't want to leave that hanging.
I might set that one off with commas too, though, I think. I mean, I don't know. So your grammar might be better than mine.
Did we have any other changes?
We had, regarding the incentives, we had the language from 119.
Although here it says, I think we.
Oh, we already got.
I think our original title with 121 talks about. Received,
yeah, let's
by the insurer.
Okay. So are we good?
I think so.
Okay, I'll read it. It's a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the disclosure of healthcare pricing information and in connection therewith requiring healthcare providers as broadly defined by the measure to publish fee schedules detailing the price charged for healthcare services, billing policies, and a list of healthcare professionals providing services, prohibiting non-complying healthcare providers from billing for services, requiring health insurers to publicly disclose coverage and payment information, including prescription drug prices for each health coverage plan and information regarding incentives received by the insurer, requiring pharmacies to publish retail drug prices, authorizing penalties for violation, and prohibiting any contract between a health insurance plan and a health care provider from restricting publication of the required health care price information.
I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 121, except to the extent that we have amended the title as was just read.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to number 122.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board, Martha Tierney on behalf of the proponents, David Silverstein and Andrew Graham, who are both present.
Mr. Rogers.
Madam Chair, Thomas Rogers for the objector, Deborah Farrell.
And do you want to walk us through your motion for rehearing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So 122, includes language that is a component of 121. So I mention that because we have now been through all of the arguments at least once. So I'm simply going to incorporate prior arguments here and leave it at that. So with regard to the substantial changes after review and comment, I would incorporate our arguments with regard to 121. With regard to single subject, I would incorporate our arguments from 121 on the requirement that healthcare providers publish a list of all persons that provide services. Otherwise, we stand in our motion. But I believe, again, with the exception of a different rulemaker for 122, all of the substance of those points has been argued in the prior initiatives.
Okay. Ms. Tierney, you have anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, we would incorporate all of our comments from all of the prior measures heard today, or motions for rehearing on 119, 120, 121, into the comments here on 122. That would be for both myself and Mr. Silverstein. And I concur with Mr. Rogers that the arguments raised in the motion for rehearing have each been already discussed in the prior motions for rehearing.
Okay. With that, looking at the title, I don't think I see anything that we've changed on prior ones that we need to change here, but does anyone think I'm missing anything there?
Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Gillander, we do have the issue of the expansive definition of healthcare provider as we addressed in 119.
Yes.
And while I'm here on language, let me just go ahead and finish that off if I could. So in addition to incorporating the arguments on title language from 119, we would also incorporate argument from 121 on title language, specifically with respect to the alternate requirements or our suggestion that the title should include a reference to the CMS fee schedule users. Otherwise, we stand in our motion.
Okay. All right, so I think you've got it.
Okay. So just with the addition on line two, requiring a broad range of healthcare providers. So, right. Going to make a motion?
Yes. I move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18, number 122, except to the extent that we've amended the title as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 123.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the title board, Martha Tierney on behalf of the proponents, David Silverstein and Andrew Graham, who are present.
Madam Chair, Thomas Rogers representing the objector, Deborah Farrell.
And you want to go ahead and start us off?
You bet. Again, we have covered the arguments made in our motion for rehearing. And so I would incorporate the substantive changes after review and comment and the single subject arguments from Initiative 121. Let me also incorporate, please, the language arguments that we made with respect to 121. Otherwise, we stand on the motion for all three topics. 121 language, not the
122. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We incorporate all of our comments for 119, 120, 121, and 122 into this motion for rehearing for number 123, my comments and Mr. Silverstein's comments. And agree that each of the issues raised in the amendment arguments, the single subject arguments, and the titling arguments have already been covered this morning.
Okay. All right. So I got a couple language or one language change at least.
I think can we go back and look at.
I think we said as broadly defined in the measure with 121.
We did.
Stephen?
Yeah. And then in this one, the difference is so we do not need that bit we had on the prescription drug devices in this one. I can't
right,
remember if
it
made
doesn't.
Any other change. Should probably look.
I don't think we did.
I think the prescription drug prices was the only
yeah.
other change.
Are you saying we don't need the prescription drug
prices? Yeah, because that one's not in here.
That's the difference between
121 and
I think the difference is just that 121 includes manufacturers as negotiation with manufacturers as opposed to just providers, pharmacies, and distributors.
That's correct. So I don't think 123 requires any change. I would, because it's a negative. I think if you wanted to make that distinction, it would go in 121.
Right.
So we should include. So we should have an identical title to 121 here, probably.
Yes. Okay. I mean.
I think so.
Yes.
All right.
All right. So then the two changes will be, I'll just read it.
Just pull it in.
Yeah.
The line numbers aren't matching up, so.
Oh, it's a problem.
So something's
okay, so now it should be the same title as 121, which is a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the disclosure of healthcare pricing information and in connection therewith requiring healthcare providers as broadly defined by the measure to publish fee schedules detailing the price charged for healthcare services, billing policies, and a list of healthcare professionals providing services, prohibiting non-complying healthcare providers from billing for services, requiring health insurers to publicly disclose coverage and payment information, including prescription drug prices for each healthcare coverage plan, and information regarding incentives received by the insurer, requiring pharmacists to publish retail drug prices, authorizing penalties for violations and prohibiting any contract between a health insurance plan and healthcare provider from restricting publication of the required health price information.
I move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 23, except to the extent that we've amended the titles as was just read.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So do we want to take a break for like half hour for lunch or one? Okay.
Totally your call.
Steve, is that okay? Yeah.
That sounds good.
All right. Then we're going to do a half hour. We'll be back at 12:40.